Off the Ball Rugby.
This is a big opportunity now for him to silence a lot of critics going into the summer with a bit of a bounce in his step, going to the Irish Tour with some confidence built up, and you know, really grab that jersey.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Yeah, you just have to be there.
You know,
yeah,
you had to be there.
And it was just great to say, like, Arlo was there for that. You know what I mean?
You have to be there.
I wish I wasn't there.
You have to be there.
All right, welcome back to the return of You Had to Be There on Off the Ball Breakfast. And it's a very special return because we're joined live in studio by Pat Daly, who is a legend of the GAA administrative game, who retired earlier this year after working 44 years full time in the GAA. Pat, good morning.
Thanks very much. Yeah, great to be here.
That's an incredible feat to work nearly half a century full time in an amateur organisation.
Yeah, it was an achievement in itself to spend that much time there. Kind of, I was a teacher in 1981, and people said to me, "You're giving up a full-time job to go working for the GAA," and I said, "I am." And you know, if somebody asked me at that stage, would it metamorphosize into 44 years? I'm not sure I would have said that would be the case. So 16 presidents of the GAA later, and the redevelopment of Croke Park, which was probably the biggest thing I've seen there. If I was there for 10 lifetimes, I don't think I'd see anything like that again. So it was an amazing journey, yeah, for 44 years.
Working under 16 different presidents, did you ever have any ambition to be president yourself?
No, I think the full-time staff kind of are part of the executive, and they carry out the executive functions of the association, I suppose, and provide an element of leadership. Like, it was very interesting, people like Peter Quinn. He probably was the driving force behind the redevelopment of Croke Park, people like himself and Liam Mulvihill. And he would say, if you're a director, you know, it's your job here to direct policy and the formulation of policy. That's your job. And I suppose there's an occupational hazard about that, because you have a lot of volunteers. You're working with a lot of volunteers who might feel they have a better understanding of what's going on than what you have. So there's a bit of tension there, yeah.
Pat, you mentioned now the redevelopment of Croke Park, but I'm actually going to list out more that you were involved in. So bear with me now. I might have to take a few deep breaths for this. So we have Féile Pelennog, Go Games, Cool Camps, Super Games, Celtic Challenge, Thon, Hawkeye, International Rules, GAA World Games, GAA All-Stars Tours, AIB Club Awards, GAA Coaching Conferences, the Yellow Slither, the Smart Slither, and Intangible Cultural Heritage Recognition for Hurling from UNESCO. Whew.
Yeah, it was a fairly diverse range of activity.
Incredible.
I thought about that, yeah. Look, I worked with a tremendous group of people, and as I say, when I joined, the advice was you lead from the front.
Right.
And if what you work, if it works, you're in business. If it doesn't, maybe you're not in business to the same extent. So I was always kind of driven by that sense of mission. And maybe we'll get back to mission, vision and ambition in a minute in a slightly different context, because people can find those terms very confusing.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, in terms of mission, for me, that's why we exist. In terms of the vision, that's how we evolve. And in terms of the ambition, that's what we measure, what we evaluate. So we're very clear about why we exist, how we evolve and what we evaluate, because the what, the how and the why of anything is the key to everything. And that sense of getting things done on that basis was always kind of there in the background someplace.
The ones in your life who said to you, like, you know, don't leave your job as a teacher to take this full-time job up, because it's probably more of a vocational aspect, despite it actually officially being a full-time of a full-time nature. How long did it take for those people in your life to say, no, this is the right path for you because you are achieving something here?
Yeah, I suppose over a period of time, people began to see that, you know, when you're working in an amateur volunteer organisation full-time, there is a bit of a tension balance there with volunteers. And there can be an element of resentment sometimes.
Did you feel that?
I think it can be there. But if the perception is you're not doing what you were employed to do, insofar as people can understand that, or you're not doing what needs to be done, that might be there. But once they see that you're facing the challenges head on and you're trying to bring the association with you, I think it changes then enormously, and people will come with you and they'll want to be part of that movement.
The GAA still has the same status as it did 4.5 decades ago when you started working full time. But in those intervening 44 years, what has fundamentally changed about the GAA?
Yeah, I remember when I went to Croke Park, there was a famous Clare hurler working there. Jimmy Smith was his name. And he said, England had won the Soccer World Cup in 1966. And he said that would be the death knell of the GAA. And it's amazing just how the thing has changed and developed into the entity it is today. Obviously, society has changed as well. There's been significant changes in society. And you look at the world of religion, you look at the world of politics, and the J, they were always deemed to be three pillars of Irish society. There's been significant changes there, probably to the extent that sport now is the fulcrum around which lots of activity happens. Mm. And that wasn't necessarily the case back then. I remember when I came to Dublin in 74, to the teacher training college in Drumcondra, if you were seen with a Hurley, you were perceived to be a bogman of some description. That has changed enormously. The perception of Hurley now is that it's kind of, it's the game to play. It's there's an element of indigenous Irishness about the thing. And that wouldn't have been there back then. I think it was Tony Hannah who said to me one time, there's parts of this city that are more anglicised than Toxted in Liverpool. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. But I think that has been a significant change in how the association is perceived.
You're a Waterford man.
Yep.
Living in Meath.
That's it.
So you played yourself?
Yeah, I played with Waterford. I really was a fullback that got converted into a full forward by my club in Tallaght. And I played for Waterford. I think according to Keane Murphy's statistics in Crown Park, I played on 19 occasions for Waterford and scored 9-7 in my time, which wasn't too bad for a fullback who became a full forward.
It's pretty good.
And there was a famous game in, we were playing Limerick of all teams in the Fraher Field in Dungarvan. It was a National League game. If we lost it, we'd be relegated, which wasn't unusual territory for Waterford at the time. But and we were 8 points down with 5 minutes to go, and we won by five. And I got a couple of goals, and legend has it that I got them against Pat Hartigan, who wasn't playing. And then other people said it was against Leonard Dinwright, whom I would have deemed to be the best fullback I played on. And he wasn't playing either, because I'm pretty sure if Leonard Dinwright was playing, I wouldn't score two goals. But so, yeah, I played with Waterford for about 3 years.
And Pat, I know you played with Waterford, but you also spoke about the importance of Waterford GAA in your younger life when you were growing up.
Yeah, it was incredible. We grew up in Tallaght, and Tallaght is on the Cork border, really. When you try and explain where Tallaght is, Yall, Fermoy and Middleton are the closest towns to it. So it really is on the border. And so back in the 60s, I suppose Ireland, you know, communications aren't what they were. And you were kind of living in Tallaght, and it was fairly well removed from any place. And cars weren't common. Mobile phones didn't exist. Mainstream phones weren't that common either. So it was, I won't call it a backwoods place, but it was difficult to get to Tallaght. Somebody once said to me, unless you're going to Tallaght, you won't ever go there. But look, growing up in Tallaght was phenomenal because of Ned Powell predominantly. He won an All-Ireland medal with Waterford in goals in 59, and he was the principal teacher in Tallaght.
Yeah.
And he was basically the driving force of Tallaght GAA. Brought a lot of people with him, and yeah, so it was a great place to grow up. And if it takes a village to raise a child, as the Indians say, that definitely was true of Tallaght.
I tell you one thing that's definitely changed 100%, undoubtedly, since 1981, your first year working full-time for the GAA, is HQ, Croke Park itself. And it's amazing now that it's become this event location. So, you know, you have massive gigs there by musicians. You have the URC rugby final taking place this weekend in that very venue, and we've seen European Cup games and rugby play there last season as well. That was probably somewhat unthinkable back in the 1980s, that Croke Park would be able to hold regular events outside of sport and other codes that can cater for so many.
Yeah, that change has been phenomenal, lots of us, in many senses, in that you're now catering for sports that at that stage would have been deemed to be your competitors. We can't provide these people with anything. We're competing with them. But I think as Ireland has opened up and as the stadium has developed, obviously there's a commercial reality around the stadium today that wasn't there then. And that reality has to be met. Now, some people might say that's gone too far and there's too much of an emphasis on concerts and things like that to the detriment of the association itself. And that's a very fine balance that has to be maintained.
I think we should emphasise for people who maybe are unaware of just how much of an influence you have had in the evolution of GAA. So the Go Games is probably the biggest thing in 2004. And you had a slogan there about, I don't want to butcher it, but it was basically, if it's not the best, forget about the rest.
Yeah, it was keep the best, forget the rest and win at all costs. And that was a huge problem.
So this was for kids?
Yeah. And we had a culture of even at under 10, people would play All-Irelands if they thought they could get away with it.
Yeah.
And like that's wrong. Fundamentally, I would have come from St. Pat's with a very child-centred approach. And you must develop the child at the centre of the process. Mullinoy.
This is your teaching background, helping.
Yeah, that's and a lot of child psychology and wonderful lectures there, philosophy education. There were some wonderful people lecturing there. Andy Bourke, who's still out in Hull today, and he's a PhD in education, and he won a junior Loyola medal with Cork in football. Who were the great, and Stefano Henricon, who was the registrar of the college, they were wonderful people to work with because they had a great understanding of what education was about and what it needed to be. And education is not about the transmission of knowledge. This fellow, Paulo Freire, would speak about the banking system of education. You're the full vessel at the top, filling all of the empty vesicles. And they're regurgitating back to you. I'm afraid that's far removed from education and what it should be. That's indoctrination by another name.
What is education?
Education is getting a person to understand that they have responsibility, he or she, for the development of themselves as people.
Right.
And facilitating that process. And we must enable people to grow. Now, there's an awful lot of confusion around flourishing and thriving and happiness. But I talk about the word grow because that's G-R-O-W is the golden rule of well-being.
So take us back to 21 years ago, the start of the Go Games, and maybe it was a bit similar to 1981 when people are saying, don't take this full-time job. People are probably saying to you then in 2004, don't do Go Games because not everyone can be a winner in life, I'm guessing was the sentiment.
Yeah, well, look, ultimately sport is competitive. There's no two ways about that. And even if you watch kids playing in walk-up games, they're competitive. But the key thing for me is it developmental?
Yeah.
And the Go Games were developmental because the emphasis wasn't on the outcome. The emphasis is on the person and the development of the person as distinct from the result. If the result is the overriding feature, the development is going to suffer. And all we were saying was that anybody who played Go Games should get a go for the entire game and they should be encouraged to develop bilateral coordination, which is another way of saying they should be able to play on their left and right hand side.
Within years, the Go Games are celebrated very quickly and fully embraced. And I do wonder, is there generally a problem in the GAA psyche about the prospects and reality of change?
There is, yeah, absolutely. I think there's a problem in every psyche about change. People generally don't like change. They will tend to stick to the status quo. So, but change is one of the great inevitabilities of life. And today you're not changing, you're not growing, you're not evolving, you're not developing. So change is inevitable. And I think, you know, getting people to appreciate it in an organisation that's been around for a long time, that can be difficult, can be challenging.
There are always challenges when anything new comes in. But one thing I think that has certainly been a success is the cool camps. Like, I just got a flashback there. I actually got a kick off my horse and my shin on a Sunday. And it was a Sunday before cool camp kicked off on the Monday. And come hell or high water, I was going to cool camp. And I was in A&E that evening getting some sort of strap on my leg. And I went down and I went for the week. And like, fair enough, the coach was like, I don't think you should play. And I was like, I'll be fine. I just didn't want to miss out on being there at cool camp. And like, we'd often try to go to another cool camp in another parish because just to get the extra, you know, time. And I think that was one of the great successes of the GAA and something that like I love now when I see, you know, the youngsters going around with their backpacks and their jerseys. I'm like, oh, must be, it's cool camp season. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was phenomenal. And look, a lot of people must get the credit for cool camps. Started with a guy called Mick Kinsler down in Wexford, who basically was tuned into reality, I suppose. And he said, more and more parents are beginning to work, so there's a need now for something in this space that wouldn't have been there prior to that. So, and in 1988, we had a meeting in the Burlington Hotel to have a look at how we deal with Ireland qualifying for soccer competitions, which draws us back to what we were talking about earlier and the use of the stadium. But the upshot of that in the Games development context was every county was given £500 at the time to organise summer camps. And after a period of time, then John Tobin, who was a great full-time person for us in Connacht, former Galway football, came to me and he said, look, Pat, we have Sony PlayStation camps, we have AIB camps, we have Garvey camps in Munster. We should put them all under the one banner. At the time, we had a magazine called Cool for Kids. Mm-hmm. A guy called Mick McCarthy, a Corkman, was driving force with that. It was published as a supplement to the Irish Times. So we decided, I said to Dan McCall, look, we'll go with Cool Camps. Just use the word Cool for Kids doesn't exist anymore, but the Cool Camps brand has moved on, and it has been phenomenal. And the level of exposure, like I'd say, thanks to VHI, who came on board, first the sponsors, then Kellogg's came in, and the level of exposure they're getting is quite incredible. And that's something that the marketing people find hard to understand, but the level of brand exposure they're getting is phenomenal, really.
And I suppose one of the other big changes we're seeing, and you've been vocal about it as well, is like the professionalisation of the game, and even club teams, not just county teams, getting outside managers in. And you seem to be of the feeling that if it's not sustainable within the club itself from volunteers, we could be running down a bit of a dangerous road in that professional sense.
Yeah, I would be a strong, an ardent proponent of self-sufficiency and sustainability on the basis of homegrown people, whether it's players, administrators or coaches. I would have come from St. Pat's College in Drumcondra, and the two previous captains of the hurling club there, but the two previous captains, as it happened, were Jill Loughnane and Brian Cody. But it was Tommy Maher was in between from Kilkenny as well. And basically it was the students that ran the club, and it was a wonderful place. And I learned more there, I'd say, than I probably learned in 10 years of subsequently, because we effectively were the people that ran the club. And what I think we should be doing is driving that culture of self-sufficiency. Now, if clubs need help, provide them with help, whatever that help is. I don't necessarily concur with a lot of what's happening in the sports science context.
Right.
Because I think GPS and S&C and all that kind of stuff are taking people away from themselves, and they're being the agent. And it's a long time ago that I came across two fellas called DC and Ryan, the two psychologists in America, and you were trying to figure out why people enjoy something. And they had self-determination theory. So basically, what are the three key elements of self-determination theory? You must feel competent, you must experience a sense of autonomy, you're driving the bus, and there must be an element of relatedness, you're with others. And I think the further we go down that road, the more we're moving away from self-determination theory, and that's a pity.
That's actually fascinating to see that side of it, because I guess, but now it's become so much part of the game, and not even just a county level, a club level as well. And even youngsters are going out for physio and S&C and diet, and everything is now being spoken about so heavily. So it's actually quite fascinating to see your view on it, because I think I would have just looked at going, well, if everyone else is doing it, I'm going to have to do it, because then do I not fall behind if I'm not keeping up with what everyone else is doing around me? But then again, is the fun element being taken away?
Yeah, absolutely. The fun element has disappeared. No. I now run a program in Rathaus called the Rathaus Rockets, and it's for kids with autism, and we go every Friday evening, and we run for 20 weeks, 20 Friday evenings from the 9th of May through to the end of September. And if somebody asks me to describe it, it's fun, it's movement, and it's communication. And to compare what we do with what might be happening in the adjoining field is quite incredible. Mm. Okay, we're catering for a different cohort, and we're going about it in a different way. But today the fun element is reduced. I think it gets so much more like work at that stage, and people perceive, I have to do it, I must do it. And if you don't want to, and if you don't believe you will do it, perception changes, and it then becomes a horse of an entirely different colour. And I think that's the space we're headed into.
Would the alternative argument to maybe the negative aspects of the sports science introduction Gaelic Games be that, well, nowadays the level has never been higher, that the players are in phenomenal condition if you look at their counterparts from two or three decades ago, and it's a rising tide idea, like that everyone is actually playing much better now. The sacrifice may be to their personal life or in sense of fun and enjoyment, which is probably what the game's still supposed to be about, but it all feels very serious at the same time.
Look, it's terribly serious, competitive sport is serious, but there's a point beyond which it doesn't need to go. And people need to be able to see the big picture. Players need to be able to see the big picture. This is not an end in itself. It's a mean to some other end. Me becoming a better person, me developing as a person, me developing with a group of people, and being clear about that and putting measures around that in the same way as GPS measures are put around things. And I think that's the space that needs to be gotten into. It's not going to be easy, because we're talking about intangible stuff.
Yes.
My late son Carl once said to me, he worked with EY, that stuff can't be measured, Dad. It's intangible, but it can be measured, in my opinion.
Is there any going back now in terms of, like Rachel meant, the professionalisation of GAA, she mentioned, and it feels like it's very difficult for the standards to drop now, knowing that you can get to those standards if you sacrifice personal elements of your life.
Yeah, I think it's the key element to all of this is what are we fundamentally talking about? And that's skill, technical, tactical, yeah. team play, physical, psychological, and participant feedback. And how do we, that's what we call the three T's and three P's, if you want total performance back in the day. And I think the three T's, the technical, the tactical, and the team play, have been sacrificed on foot of the sports science thing. And it's very interesting. When I started out, there was a guy called Professor Tom Riley, and he was from Hollymount in Mayo, a wonderful person, and he was Professor of Sports Science in John Moores University in Liverpool.
Yeah.
And that's where sports science started. And he initiated all of this by going to Everton with a video camera, and he was videoing Everton and giving them some feedback. And that's where the whole thing developed. And I remember meeting him and Mike Hughes subsequently, and they had all this, what was called notational analysis. It was just mind-boggling stuff. And I said, look, lads, where's this going to finish? You know, every game takes on a life of its own. We saw last Saturday evening in Limerick something that finished up totally different a couple of weeks earlier. You got a different result last Saturday. So every game takes on a life of its own. And I think the essential thing is guys have the prerequisites to play that game, the technical, the tactical,
yeah.
team play.
Well, to give people context, there are the three T's and the three P's you mentioned. You devised the total performance coaching framework.
Mm.
Which is based on technical precision, tactical prowess, team play, physical fitness, psychological focus, and participant feedback.
Yeah. Well, that's really what it is. I think they are the central elements, and they have to be feeding into the system all of the time.
Mm.
And analysis has to be on the basis of that. I was talking to somebody recently who got relieved of his duties as a coach in a club here in Dublin. I won't say what club. I won't name the person or the difference to the guy concerned. And they had been beaten pretty comprehensively by Nafina. So they sat down and had a review, and it was basically shortcomings in a technical, tactical team play context. But the player's perception was GPS and S&C. That's where their needs were. That's what their perception of what they needed to do. And so they had an anonymous player survey, and I said, if they're one of those, you're more than likely on your way out at that stage.
Yeah.
And so that's more of it. Like, and I think coaches need to be upfront with players and say, this is what we're developing. Now evaluate me against whether we did or didn't.
Is the expectation of a modern senior inter-county player fair on them?
It's not. It's not really. And they're probably not fair on themselves either, because they're too demanding on themselves. But in the context, and maybe this goes back to our competitive structures, I still think there's a good bit of work to be done there in terms of ensuring they're fit for purpose. And that started in 1997 when the backdoor in hurling was introduced. Mm. And we've seen a gradual evolution since then, but I don't think that's completed. And, okay, you have a tiered system in hurling. You need a tiered system in football. And in my opinion, the National League feeding into a provincial system, and then you get seeded for an All-Ireland series. And I think that's what's required. And I think inevitably it'll keep pushing in that way, because that's what fairness demands. And if that's what fairness demands, I remember saying to Jimmy McGuinness, meeting him at one stage, Jimmy was on an international rules team back in 88, 89, and we were in Scotland at a hurling Chinty International, and Glasgow Celtic was then the same hotel. And the receptionist very kindly got Jimmy in. So I was talking to him, and he said, it's a hell of a lot harder to come out of Ulster than it is to come out of Munster in football, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And he said, until you square that circle, you know, the need for change is going to go on. And that's what's happening, I think. But eventually that will happen. You will have a system where people have realistic prospects of success. And they can then say to themselves, look, we're in a competition where we're getting meaningful games and where we have realistic prospects of success. Like, a Waterford football, realistically, a footballer has no chance of ever winning anything at the higher level in football. It's not going to happen.
No.
Not even in the Tottenham Cup.
No, they beat Tipperary, was it last year, the year before. That was a good one. We'll get to your list, actually, because you had to be there. This is very eclectic, but we're joined here by Pat Daly, who's a legendary GA administrator, and so many other elements to your career. In 1991, you edited the Gaelic Football Skills, Hurling and Camogie Skill Manuals for Children. In 1992, you authored the Complete Guide to Gaelic Games for Adolescents and Adults. We talked about the three T's and the three P's. We mentioned the Go Games. What is your legacy, do you think?
Look, it's a mixture of all those things, really. At the time, if you wanted information and coaching, it was pretty hard to come by. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was very little material there. It was basically books. And if you couldn't access those books, you couldn't access the material. At the time, in Croke Park, a lot of what we produced was stenciled, photocopied notes. I felt that didn't adequately reflect who we were, what we were, and what we potentially could be as an organisation. So we put these manuals together with assistance from a lot of people. And they were groundbreaking. And the thing about it is that if you took out those manuals today and gave them to anybody, they're just as relevant today as they were back then.
What was your source material?
Basically, on the it was interesting. Owen Liston was employed as a football development officer in Munster. And Owen got injured, and it was decided that he'd put a manual together on football skills and football skill development for kids. And then Owen got back up and running again. So the manual kind of got pumped, but somebody asked me, Michael O'Connor, he was chairman of the Munster Council, would I finish off the job? And so that was the background to that. And if we were doing it for football, we had to do it for hurling. We did. And I had Ned Power and Brendan O'Sullivan and Dennis Bodden's wonderful people, Brendan from Kilkenny. Dennis Bodden's won All-Ireland medals with Cork. And so they were involved on the hurling side of things. And then I had to go out to complete coaching guide myself. I edited that myself. And basically what I was trying to do, I was basically a practitioner. And I said, now, can I take the theory that supplements the practice? And what I discovered fairly quickly from dealing with theoreticians and sports scientists, they really couldn't embed the practice in the theory. They'd give you any amount of theory, but they struggled and really found it difficult to embed the practice in the theory. So I was coming at it from the reverse angle. I said, I'm a good practitioner. No, what theory do we need to back this up? So that's where that came from. And that was, yeah, a lot of sources. We drew on a lot of sources. There wasn't too many around at the time, whatever you could get your hands on, basically.
What was the golden age of Gaelic games?
I think, you know, every age is a golden age of Gaelic games in its own right. You know, it's an amazing organisation. It's a complex organisation. Mm. You've hurling and football for starters. Okay, so the last couple of years in football haven't been great for reasons, I think, that rule changes didn't keep abreast of what needed to be done in the game. A number of years ago, I sat in the rules standing committee of the playing rules, and we were proposing after 3 hand passes, you'd have to kick the ball.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's elementary. You know, I'm not going to criticise what the FRC are doing because I've been involved in many changes like that over the years that were prematurely knocked. But I still think that there's a problem with hand passing, and the ball needs to be kicked, and we need to get contest for possession, because traditionally the game has been played on the edge of chaos, and that's where a lot, that's where the inherent attraction of it comes from. That element needs to be put back into the game.
What about the state of hurling?
Hurling could do with the disciplinary changes that that have been introduced in football. No two ways about that. Like a number of years ago, 2019, Central Council passed a number of guiding principles. I won't go into the 7 of them, but the first was the game is played in a fair manner with total respect for match officials. That is absolutely fundamental and essential. I think the football guys have got a fair distance down the road in that. But in terms of rule changes in hurling, you know, the hand pass is not going to be dealt with, unfortunately. But what I would say, if you take a hand pass, you must strike the ball with the hurley. So put the emphasis back on the hurley. It's hurling is the name of the game, not hand pass. Same with football. It's football.
That was put to Congress, wasn't it? Something like that. It was defeated.
Conor O'Donovan has been pushing for a long time. So you'd have to toss the ball and strike it.
Yeah, he was on with us. Talk about it.
Yeah. Well, look, that wasn't accepted. And I'd say, fair enough, it's not going to be accepted. Let's go the other route. Put the emphasis back on using the hurley. I see a practice now, a guy sliding into the ball, which is something I hadn't seen. It's beginning to creep in. Not only are we getting rooks, but we're getting guys sliding into to kind of cover the ball. I think any guy who goes off his feet should be an immediate free against him. To cover that before it becomes another feature of the game that we could well do without.
Did you have a particularly close relationship with any of the 16 presidents you worked with?
I suppose Peter Quinn, I would have had a good relationship with Peter Quinn because he was the person that was kind of driving executive responsibility and the need for that and the need for accountability. Then if you do have executive responsibility, so how do we measure impact and how do we evaluate what you're doing? Joe McDonough as well, because I played against Joe McDonough. Joe played with Galway and I played with Waterford. And one of the more interesting jobs I got in Croke Park was to become secretary of Coisteann na Gaeilge. You know, lots of committees in Croke Park, but Coisteann na Gaeilge is the one that looks after Irish, and Joe was chairman of that, and I was asked would I become secretary. So I met up with Joe there again, and he was a wonderful person. You know, he'd he was a real ambassador for the GAA and his incredible energy and enthusiasm. But look, all 16 presidents, every one of them brought something different in their own unique way. But of the two that I suppose I would have worked closely, most close with, it would have been Peter Quinn and Joe McNaughton.
We should start your list here. You had to be their list. So I'm just going to state the event and please talk openly about it. We'll go chronologically. So we'll start the year that England won the World Cup, of course, 1966. The under-16 Waterford County football final played in Carrickonshire between Tallow and Mount Sion.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting backstory there, because how could a Waterford final be played in Carrickonshire? Really, the reason for that was Ned Parr was coaching the Tallow under-16 football team, and Seamus Parr, who was playing with Waterford, both of them were playing with Waterford, was coaching the Mount Sion team. And Waterford were playing Tipperary in a National League game in Carrickonshire, so this game went in as a curtain raiser in Carrickonshire. So that's how it was played. And if Ireland won this, if England won the World Cup in 1966, Tallow won the World Cup when they won that competition. It was just incredible, because I don't think Tallow had been successful ever at underage competition prior to that. And it was phenomenal. I was there as an 8 or 9 year old, and it was just phenomenal. They never forget it. I can still remember it vividly, when lots of other things in the interim I've forgotten about. And it triggered the wonderful 20 years of success for Tallow GAA, where we won 3 senior hurling championships, 80, 84 and 85. Played against my brother in 85, but I wouldn't be going about that too much. And, you know, it then kind of turned in 86, and we haven't been as successful since. But look, there's wonderful facilities down in Tallow now. They're working away on that, and they're working at trying to get back up to where they were. They've gone down intermediate this year, which was a bit of a pity. But that was a phenomenal day.
The 1990 Irish Grand National isn't very was, yeah.
I went to live in Rathaut, and to be honest, I didn't know where Rathaut was. A friend of mine said, maybe it's not a bad place to live, when I got married in 88. So I went to live in Rathaut, and obviously the Grand National is a huge thing around Rathaut. And as it happens, I bought a house in the Fairy Hill side of Rathaut, so we could walk up through 2 fields to the Grand National. And we'd done that, and people were driving up in cars and into the fields. And it was just a phenomenal occasion. If you went to the Grand National today, you couldn't drive up through the fields, I can tell you, and get there. That's all gone. And there was a multitude of people there, and there was a white horse, Desert Orchid. He won the race.
Yeah. I'm just looking here.
He brought in, there was an enormous amount of people. Now, you get a lot of people from the north and Dublin going to the Grand National.
Yeah.
But today it's more about entertainment and young people and all that kind of thing. It's changed enormously. But That was phenomenal. For me, being new to Rathaut, being new to the Grand National, I just found that intriguing.
Eben's favourite was Desert Orchard.
He was the favourite.
Yeah. Barney Burnett second, 16-1.
Wow. Yeah. That'd be nice each way.
Yeah.
I'm big into the horse racing, because that's kind of my background, actually, was horses. So it's funny, because I came into GAA a little bit later in life, and you're talking about getting everyone playing GAA, and I struggled to get on the pitch. So I used to follow my coach up and down, like, can you put me on? And I stayed at it until I got there, because I was determined to make it until I eventually was getting a start in place. But besides that, funny, the horse racing there, you mentioned Desert Orchid. Actually, one of the first horses I had after I transitioned from ponies, I was given this beautiful white, snow white horse, and my dad's like, this is Desert Orchid. He's actually been retired from racing, and you have got him. And I was like, oh my God. So I was going around telling everyone that I had Desert Orchid. I didn't have Desert Orchid at all. It was a cob that his friend had for years that was retiring. But I was going around telling people that Desert Orchid had retired with me. And I just find the horse race for me has always been phenomenal, and just going to racetracks, I remember when I put my first bet on, it wasn't real, but my father's like, pick a horse. So back in the mid-90s, I was Istabrak all the way. And I remember Istabrak winning that time, the champion hurdle. And I was like telling everyone that, I went into put money on him, my dad gave me probably £1 and said, there's your winnings. But I think horse racing like that, it always invokes memories, because we all kind of remember the big days, and whatever age you are, or the occasion as well.
Yeah, that was a phenomenal occasion. It still means a lot locally in Rathaut. Still a big day, huge day. The Irish Grand National, and people would say it should be moved out of Easter, it's not suitable when Easter's early or late, but look, it is what it is, and it's been there a long time, and I think we should respect that.
The 2004 International Rules Test game at Croke Park that featured the dog, our own Shane Hannan did us a very special report on this dog.
Yeah, I saw that. I never knew where that dog came from until
it was a house down the road, basically. Yeah.
And there was a couple of dubs after that game, and there wasn't much to discuss, because there was no acrimony about who was the player of the game, but the dub figures was the dog. And in 2006, it was interesting, there was a kind of in 2006, the first game then was played in Galway, and Galway had installed floodlights, and they had no nets.
I remember.
So there was footballs disappearing at a rate of knots. And somebody said, we're going to run out of footballs here. So we were going to have the dog in Crow Park. We were going to be in a doghouse in Galway. So there was a guard escort down to the Adelon Hotel to get footballs. We put a guard at the end. Not sure if G-Soccer had allowed us into there to make sure we were getting footballs back for the game. And then in 2006 that year, it finished in a dogfight. So the dog was prominent for a bit of the international rules. But look, that was interesting. That was interesting as well.
Yeah.
Will we see it again?
Yeah.
There's a lot of talks about it coming up, especially males and females. You know, I think that could be even a more interesting one. We've so many Irish players over playing in the AFLW. We'd be confident going in, I'd say, from a female point of view, that we'd get the win.
Yeah, look, it's wonderful to see people like Vicky Wall, who's done very well with Meath out there, and you know, holding their own. And yeah, it would be interesting. Yeah, having the female tour side of it wouldn't have been contemplated back in 98, 99, when it was reactivated from the 80s. Just no consideration. But that's another indication of how things have changed and how much more prominent the female side of the association.
Yeah.
Our females have become within the association. And that has been transformative as well.
Do you think integration will happen?
I think it will. to be honest about it, I would have said 2034 was a more realistic date for total integration in the 150th centenary of the association, because it's a big task. There's a lot of moving parts and it's not going to be easy to draw them together. But I suppose if it was shoved out until then, people would say we're not going to get there. So they're talking about 2027 and it's going to be a challenge. Mm.
I said it was an eclectic list. 2013, Pearce Stadium, Galway Buenos Aires Hurling Club versus Denver Indianapolis in the native born hurling final.
Yeah, well, look, there was a guy called John Concannon. He was involved with the government. And after the crash, he said that the gathering should be organised to get people to come back to Ireland, support Ireland. Etihad and Aer Lingus decided to sponsor the gathering, a hurling tournament that was played in Galway. And prior to that, Páraic McShay, who played full back with Donegal back in the day in football, had been on to us about giving support to the hurling club of Buenos Aires, which effectively now is a hockey and a rugby club. Hurling had dissipated there, notwithstanding the fact it's situated in Hurlingham in Buenos Aires. So the team came from Buenos Aires and they were a native-born team made up of Brazilians or guys from Argentina. And they were playing against Denver, Indianapolis, that had won the American native-born championship. And it was the most incredible game of hurling I've ever seen.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The enthusiasm, the tenacity. Like you effectively were watching hockey players with a rugby background competing against guys who had no background in hurling. And it was just amazing. The American guys won it by a point after one of the Argentinians was deemed to have thrown the ball. But it was just incredible. And we had
Conor Donovan was like, yeah, I told you it happened.
George O'Connor, the famous Wexford George, had gone to Argentina on a few occasions with Martin Lynch promoting hurling in the hurling club. And guys like Kieran McGreeny came and Ronnie Quinn wasn't able to make it from Argentina, but they were wonderful people. And Hernan subsequently passed away and his family, all of them, came from Buenos Aires to donate all of his stuff to the museum in Crow Park. So they had wonderful passion and pride in the fact that they were Irish and the fact that they were hurling people.
Do you remember any of this, Galway?
2013, I had just moved to London for my internship with MTV, so I was in the showbiz world and I remember like, I remember what happened, but I was completely out of the loop.
Yeah, but look, I spoke about former presidents. Liam O'Neill would have been a big, very big, strong proponent of the whole international side of things, as would Egon O'Farrell. You know, as it happened, we were in college many years before that, as was Martin Fogarty and Paddy O'Neill, who was involved with Tipperary. But they could see the benefit and the value in the international game.
And finally, on Pat Daly's You Had To Be There list is the last and most recent entry, 2016 UCD Oman versus South African Gales in the plate final for the native-born team participating in the GAA World Games.
It was just phenomenal, really. You had kids from the townships in Johannesburg. Wonderful guy called Paul Carpenter from Yorkshire, who knew nothing about Gaelic games, but could see the merit in having a community-based operation. He set up the South African Gales. And there were Steph McQuaid, who was, I think she had a school of some description in Oman, an English teaching school, and she set up the Omani, the team in Oman. And oh, it was incredible, like the passion. The South Africans were unreal because the ball might be coming and you'd imagine a guy is going to catch it, but he would try and fly kick it. You know, so they were into all sorts of original stuff. And the sense of community, they mightn't have had much economically, but the sense of togetherness they had was just incredible.
Is it almost where you want to see the game going back to, like what you're describing in these last two games, just creativity, people playing for the joy of it? Is that where you'd like to see the games
going? The game is played on the edge of chaos. All good sports are played on the edge of chaos because that's where the unpredictability comes out of. Now, coaches inevitably will try and take that out and make it totally predictable. And somebody said, what was in the game plan? If there's one term that irritates me, it's game plan. Because Peter McGinnity said everything that worked was in the game plan and anything that didn't work wasn't in the game.
And what a way to wrap Pat Daly's You Had to Be There.
You Had to Be There.